From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Most weeks, LA Times food critic Jonathan Gold gives us a restaurant to try in Los Angeles. This week, Jonathan's got something special to share with us. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, Evan.
So this week is a pretty special week.
It's the week that the 101 comes out. Which is my list for the LA Times of the 101 best restaurants in Los Angeles area in order.
Everybody was wondering if Vespertine would be on the list, and there it was, right in number one position.
People seem surprised by that, and I guess I can see it because it's definitely a restaurant that's not everybody's taste, but I think that it is perfect at what it does.
And you've said before that what it does goes beyond just putting food on a plate. It's sort of a seamless artistic experience.
Yeah, I described it in my review as a Gesamtkunstwerk, of a completely pretentious term usually associated with Richard Wagner, which means a total work of art, which means that, you know, the ceramics are made specially. There's a soundtrack of just a few notes that plays all night by the restaurant. It's like an evening of avant-garde theater as much as it is a dinner. They don't really describe what you're eating, and the combinations are often things you've never had before. And even when you're looking at something familiar, there'll be like a leaf of wormwood in there, which is just so incredibly bitter and it'll confuse you a little bit. You're meant to be kept off balance.
Okay, so that's number one. Number two is the restaurant that occupied the number one spot for years.
Yeah, Providence had been number one, I think, every year I've done this list for the LA Times. It's a spectacular place. The food is stunningly good. Michael Cimarusti, the chef, does all the things I wish every chef would do in terms of, you know, sourcing local sustainable seafood.
Now, number three, Spago, has been on the list forever. How is it that a restaurant with that longevity has managed to maintain its chops while the city has evolved and the quality of the offerings in the city have exploded over the years since Spago first opened?
I think it's part of the genius of Wolfgang Puck, whose ideas are behind so much of what exists in not just the city's restaurant culture, but maybe the world's, that he's able to reinvent the restaurant every so often. Everybody loved the old Spago, and they loved the comfort of the, you know, the piece of pasta and salad. He moved to Beverly Hills, which I still can't believe is 20 years ago, though I guess it was.
Okay, then number four, is this the first time that this restaurant has been up in the top few spots?
Luxon has been flirting with the top of the list for quite a while. I think Sang-Yoon, who, you know, we have on the show a lot, is a really good thinker about food. I sometimes say that, you know, somebody should walk 3 feet behind him, you know, gathering his sort of ideas that he has and then throws away. Luxon is supposed to go to a tasting format soon, or at least be able to encompass a tasting format. But at the moment, it's a place where you can go sit on a really comfortable patio and eat the kind of food that is perfectly capable of being awarded, you know, 3 Michelin stars for a small fraction of the price.
Okay, then with number five, we're at Taco Maria.
I think Carlos Salgado is doing some of the most innovative modern Mexican cooking in the United States, period. Every time I go there, I'm surprised at something that I see, whether it's spectacular sturgeon taco in a blue corn tortilla made from the corn that he brings in from Mexico himself, or a ceviche of just the loveliest scallops, or maybe even just a carnitas taco, but with the carnitas being regarded with the kind of care that you almost never see.
So the next few are familiar. We have Tuamek, Casilla, and the Mozzaplex. But then at number 10, the final on the top 10, is a new restaurant.
It's Rosso Blu, which is a new northern Italian restaurant. It's focusing on the cooking of Bologna, which is something that you almost wouldn't figure works in Los Angeles. I mean, Bologna cooking is heavy. The pastas are handmade. There's no shortage of cream or butter or cheese or heavy meats, but somehow it works in its space. I think it's going to be the anchor for its new neighborhood. I think if you're looking at the area south of downtown, in what used to be the Fashion District, I think that Rosa Blue is going to be the natural center of what's going to be an exciting restaurant scene in the next few years.
Okay, now I have to ask you about a few things that aren't on the list that are surprising a lot of people, most particularly Felix.
I think that what Evan Funky is doing is good. The flavors are strong and bright. Some of the vegetable dishes are lovely. Everybody loves being in the restaurant. But I have strong disagreements with him on the way that he makes pasta, I suppose. Instead of having fresh pasta that's sort of supple and to the tooth and almost alive, it's just not as lovely as it could be.
Okay, so now that we've gotten a taste of the list, I want to ask you about a giant chef in town who had influenced so many, particularly in the Thai restaurant scene, Chef Chui from Jit La Da, that we lost last week.
It was a huge loss to the restaurant scene here. When Tui and his sister Jazz took over Jit La Da in the late aughts, it had been the restaurant Thai people would always send you to. The food was correct, and it was a nice room, but it was a little staid. He developed this menu of cooking he'd grown up eating from southern Thailand, you know, which is famous for having the strongest flavored food in Thailand, which, given Thailand, is saying a lot. It became enormously popular. People were coming for the dishes that Tui was doing from his area. And I think it was the first time in L.A. cooking where chefs realized that they didn't have to cook for what they imagined that, say, non-Thais or non-people of whatever group expected, that they could cook their best food the way that they knew how and that people would come. I think that a lot of what's going on in the restaurant community in Los Angeles may not be directly connected to what Tui did, but I think that he was very influential in pushing the conversation forward.
Well, thank you so much, Jonathan.
Thank you, Evan. It's been great.
That's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food critic for the LA Times, Jonathan Gold. We've been talking about the legacy of Chef Tui, who is the beloved chef of Jit La Da in LA's Thai Town. We also talked about Jonathan's new list of 101 best restaurants in LA. You can find the list at latimes.com and text the words good food to 69866 to get Jonathan's weekly restaurant recommendations. Next, a new biography of a food writer who you may not have heard of. That's when the show continues. Stay with us. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman.
Well, it's interesting because I sort of had the same feeling that you did, that, you know, why hadn't anyone taken on this marvelous subject before I did?
That's Adam Fetterman talking about food writer Patience Gray. She's the author of the 1986 book Honey from a Weed. Fetterman's just written a biography of Gray. It's called Fasting and Feasting.
I actually hadn't heard of Patience until after she died in 2005, when I came across an obituary in The Art of Eating magazine, which described Honey from a Weed in, you know, very sort of grandiose terms as one of the best food books that will ever be written. It turned out my parents actually had a copy of Honey from a Weed on their bookcase, and I was immediately sort of swept up in the prose of the book, and from there just gradually started to learn more about who she was.
Where did she come from?
Well, she was born in Surrey in England in 1917, October 31st, in fact, Halloween, which in later years patients liked to tell people. She was a Scorpio and a proud one at that. She attended university in London, you know, raised her children in London as well. And she's largely, to the extent that she is known, she's known from Honey from a Weed, which is an account of her life, of course, in the Mediterranean and traveling to all of these remote places. But she lived this earlier life that was equally unusual and independent and just very different from the life that she would later live.
How do you mean? The fact that it was very sort of upper middle class, privileged?
That, and also, of course, very urban. And, you know, she was very socially engaged and very much tapped into the sort of post-war artistic and literary scene in Hampstead, where she lived. And of course, you know, she didn't really have much of an interest in food at that time. During the war, she had started to do a bit of foraging and explore sort of the natural world in that way. But it wasn't, of course, until she wrote her first cookbook, Plat du Jour, which was published in 1957, that she really kind of took on food as a subject.
She talks about her life before she met the great love of her life and her life after. Could you talk about him and how they met and where they ended up living?
Yeah, of course, Norman Momans, a Belgian sculptor, she met in 1958 at a mutual friend's cottage where they had both gone to celebrate the summer solstice. It was really a turning point in both of their lives, and it spurred their sort of journey throughout the Mediterranean. They fed off each other in interesting ways. And, you know, Norman was a very creative spirit. He really encouraged Patience to pursue her artistic interests and sort of leave behind the world of journalism and pursuing a career that she was enmeshed in London. So when they left London in 1962, that was really kind of a pivotal moment for both of them.
It's sort of like they embraced a kind of artistic hippie life. They chose to live in places where there was no infrastructure, for example.
That's right. Ostensibly, we're searching for marble. Norman was a sculptor and carving, so they went, Patience writes in Honey from a Weed, that a vein of marble runs through the book. And that's true, but it was also the case that those places tended to be primitive, remote, elemental in a way that they were also both searching to sort of allow them to live the kind of life that they wanted to live. But it should also be noted, I think, that it took them a long time to settle into that, and they spent years searching for that sort of ideal place to live and work.
Was she a person who made friends easily in the villages and these rural settings in which she and Norman found themselves?
I think she did have a knack for engaging with local people, peasants, laborers, and particularly women. But she also had access to a kind of male culture of the bars and quarries because of Norman. And she was an incredibly acute observer and able to pick up on local traditions and ways of cooking, I think, in a way that was quite remarkable. You know, she was both an outsider, but able to engage with the local people.
Only two of her works were published during her lifetime, Plat du Jour, which you spoke about earlier, and Honey from a Weed. Could you describe the way each describes food?
Yeah, they're very different books. Plat du Jour, published in 1957 by Penguin, and was the first sort of mass market paperback of its kind, and it sold quite well. And it was really a collection of recipes from across Europe. Patience co-wrote the book with a colleague named Primrose Boyd, and they were both amateur cooks, and the book has a very accessible, sort of friendly tone. And of course, it was published just a few years after rationing had ended in England. So many women in their position were looking for books of that kind. And of course, Elizabeth David had published several books in the years before that were also quite successful. But Plat du Jour, nearly 30 years passed between the publication of Plat du Jour and Honey from a Weed, which is a completely different kind of book, much more based on Patience's experience. And, you know, you can just feel the way that she had absorbed this knowledge from the people that they lived among.
Could you talk about Spigolizzi, the farmhouse in Puglia that Patience shared with Norman?
Yeah, so Spigolizzi is the home that they, well, farmhouse that they found in 1969 on a trip to Puglia, and where they moved in 1970 and which became their home for the rest of their lives. When they discovered it, it was a rundown shepherd's temporary structure, and you know, it needed a huge amount of work, quite cold in the winters, simple stone structure that abuts the macchia, the Mediterranean scrub, which Patience came to really feel at home in. And it's an incredibly striking, somewhat austere landscape at the tip of the Puglian Peninsula. So you're surrounded by coastline on three sides, and it has quite dramatic views, and surrounded by olive trees and just sort of the harsh red clay soil of the region.
Imagine what she would have done if Instagram had existed then.
Yeah, that's a very interesting thought. I mean, Patience was famously sort of hostile to technology, but she did like to take photographs. And in her memoir, Work Adventures, Childhood Dreams, she includes a number of her own photos. And she loved to draw. Of course, she died in 2005, so the internet was alive and well at that point. But she stuck to her Olivetti typewriter until just about the time that she died in 2005.
Our awareness of her sort of came onto the scene at a time when it was before slow food, and yet those of us who had traveled early, like in the 70s, to Europe could feel by the time Honey from a Weed came out that things had really changed, that so much of Europe was becoming first world. And I think much of the reaction to this book was sort of a yearning for this idealized rural past.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. And it's interesting, too, to note that she had finished a first draft of the book in 1970. And of course, it wasn't published until 1986. So that interim period was one of dramatic change. And Patience was observing it herself. And of course, she included a lot of the traditional ways of cooking and preparing food from Puglia after they had moved there in 1970. And you do feel this tension in the book between the celebration of this, you know, Patience described it as a fast disappearing way of life, and what was replacing it.
I understand that she was dubbed a modern-day witch of sorts.
That description was used by a handful of people. Even one of her granddaughters said she looked rather like a witch toward the end of her life. You know, and she had this vast knowledge of edible wild plants and mushrooms and sort of lived off the land. It's an image that she didn't necessarily shy away from. There were many facets to Patience, and that was just one of them.
Did you ever cook anything from Honey from a Weed?
Yeah, I've cooked a handful of recipes. I mean, I'm slightly embarrassed to say that I haven't cooked a lot from the book. It tends to be the kind of book that people read rather than actually use. But the book is marvelous, and I really do encourage people to use it as a cookbook.
Give us an idea of one dish.
Well, there's a section on potatoes, actually, that I really like. The dishes are unbelievably simple and just wonderful. There's a dish of potatoes with alliums that I've cooked recently, and potatoes boiled with their skins removed and then cooked in whatever kind of alliums you might have lying around, garlic, onions, shallots, scallions, which are just lightly sautéed in olive oil. And then you sort of fold in the potatoes and add a generous amount of black pepper, pinch of salt, and that's basically it.
Adam Fetterman is the author of Fasting and Feasting, The Life of Visionary Food Writer Patience Gray. You know, I grew up in L.A. during a time when we had over 100 stage 4 smog alerts a year. Walking home from school, I remember viscerally what smog tastes like. So imagine my surprise when I heard about L.A. artist Kim Abeles, whose work marries the food we eat with smog.
I had lived in a very idyllic setting in southeastern Ohio, living in a grain silo, farming and all that. Came to L.A., instantly noticed the pains and the burning eyes and all that of the smog. And in the late 70s, you couldn't convince people that's what it was.
When people complain about it now, I have to say I'm like one of those old people who says, you should have been there in the old days. How do you get this visualization of smog onto the plate?
I make a stencil of imagery that I draw, and I cut the stencil out, and then I put them on the plates, and then the plates are placed up on a rooftop for varying lengths of time, and the smog is very heavy, so it falls upon that. And when I bring that plate down, I take off that stencil, and then the image that appears is from that smog in the air.
So powerful. I mean, it's something that we don't even think about. So much of your work explores relationships between society, geography, and the environment. What do you think is the responsibility of the artist to incorporate politics into their art?
I think it's a big responsibility. I started out as a studio artist and quickly saw that my better role was describing things that people either don't want to think about or don't want to know about or have trouble understanding, and using my visual strengths, really, in the way I always think and see things, and translate it into artworks.
Yeah, it's amazing how sometimes art acts as like a punctuation, where you don't realize anything, then you see a piece, and then it transforms how you see.
You can't clobber people over the head with your impressions of things. I always think of it like P.T. Barnum, get him in the tent, so that then they will have this moment where they can reflect upon it, and then it will return daily and weekly to them, those impressions that the artworks make.
Tell me what part of L.A. you live in.
Well, right now I live in Pasadena, so that's a relatively new thing for us. But over 3 decades, I lived in downtown L.A., and that was part of it. My first studios were in, you know, like 1980 on Broadway in the Victor Clothing Building. And I was always very fascinated by the fact I couldn't see the San Gabriel Mountains, even though they were just up the street, really, from where I was. That whole experience of being there, and I grew up in Pittsburgh, which is another city that had a long history during the steel industry of polluted air. I sort of made my perfect home there.
Let's talk about the medium of some of your work, the plate. I mean, here on this show, we think of the plate as being something which usually is a vessel for beauty and sustenance. And you've taken the plate and you've kind of turned it on its head.
We always feel really safe in our homes. I mean, I think that's part of it. And your comment about feeling like you could taste the smog even, we do ingest that particulate. Kids, when they're running, you know, it's just like going way into their lungs, right? So I do like that contradiction that you would have a meal made out of smog, in specific terms, the particulate matter that lingers in the air, which is why we have the visibility issues. We're not able to see far away, right? And that is a contradiction with this idea of putting my daughter's meal on her high chair and the meal is made out of smog. So that cute little bowl of soup and peanut butter and jelly sandwich is now something that is really harmful.
You're best known for your smog series that commemorates dinner plates of the U.S. presidents. The cleaner the plate, the stronger his environmental record. I think about what you might do with this current administration.
Yeah, I already have sketchbooks full of ideas. It's almost a little too easy for me in a certain way. I picture a stack of plates that are just completely smog-filled with his image actually made as the clean part of the plate, some sort of odd, squeaky clean image.
So previous to our current president, who in the past have been some of our cleaner plate presidents?
A favorite of mine is Jimmy Carter. I still think he does things that a president would be doing for our society as a leader. I did think that the Roosevelts tried. There's really no president that has some perfect record on it. In the case of the ones that I felt had better environmental records, I left out for 4 days. And when their environmental records were bad, as in the case of like Ronald Reagan, I left it out for 40 days. So it's grades of gray that you see.
Wow. I'm wondering if your time studying in Athens, Ohio, impacted the way you incorporate environmental issues into your work. I'm thinking about when the Cuyahoga River caught fire.
When I lived there, I made a lot of strong use of the land, like clay and so on, to make ceramic pieces. It's more a distance between what that kind of lifestyle was. And I wrote a crafts, cookery, and country living book when I was in my early 20s, and really living on the land was all that I was about. So then picture me then coming to Los Angeles to go to grad school and just horrified by what nobody else seemed to see around me. You know, I'd go to a coffee shop and people would just insist that was fog that I was seeing. Now, you couldn't even imagine that now, right? But at the time, people were in like pretty severe denial about what it was. And part of that is when you grow up in a place, that becomes your reality and your normal, right? So I think it was really that contradiction of that living out in the countryside that really pushed my need to really explain all this visually to people.
For your latest exhibition, you've created an entire dining room with a table and chairs, a high chair, baby bassinet, and a window. And the plates, the dinnerware, the food, the toys, and the view are all made of smog. I understand that you currently live with four generations of family under the same roof. Does this familial living experience have a direct impact on this piece of work?
I think it does because of the age differences between those four generations. My granddaughter will turn 10 next month. My mother is 97 and still in very good health, but has obviously lots of different types of memories of growing up, you know, in St. Louis and then Pittsburgh and how that air is. It's hard not to think toward that next generation with a strong sense of responsibility that maybe we can catch some of this issue and get people talking more seriously about things like climate change. I know we're in a shift moment right now, which is why I think it makes me want to work harder, because this is sort of the moment we've all been perched ready to jump on in order to really start changing not only laws, but even the way we work with our own lives on a daily basis.
Yeah, I mean, one of the strengths of your work and what really spoke to me was this sense of the fallacy of how while we're inside, we're safe.
Like a window's not going to help you, right? You know, I grew up in the 50s, and if people kept their kitchens clean, that's all anybody cared about. They didn't care how they got there with that clean kitchen, but that was really a primary focus. And, of course, now we know all the hazards that people have underneath their kitchen sinks and so on. So there's a whole shift of idea of what are the priorities here in the way we push on every day of our lives, right?
That's conceptual artist Kim Abeles. Her latest exhibit includes a series called Smog Collectors. It's on view at Orange Coast College through December 8th. Next up, the author of a 2,600-page book about bread. No kidding. Stay with us. I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW.
If you've got a beef rib roast and it's, you know, 6-8 inches long, that could take hours to bake in the oven. If you have a loaf of bread about that size, it bakes in 20 minutes. How come it's so much faster?
That's one of the questions posed by Nathan Myhrvold and his team in a new 2,600-page opus called Modernist Bread. The 5-volume book explores the history, science, and practice of, you guessed it, making bread. Seeing as bread is as old as time, is modernist bread an oxymoron?
It's totally an oxymoron. Not only is bread one of the oldest foods of mankind, but for the last 30 years or so, the general ethos of the bread world has been around artisanal handmade products that hearkened to another age. You had bakers react to the machine-made breads that were in the supermarkets by saying, hey, let's go back to better bread of the past. And so that has been the dominant way people think about bread.
How long have you personally been baking bread?
I first made bread when I was 9 or 10, with a little bit of help. But pretty soon after that, I started making it all by myself.
So you have been one of those people who went deep into the rabbit hole.
Oh, I went so deep into the rabbit hole, it pretty much came out the other side of the earth.
Why do you think it is that we're still so obsessed with perfecting it?
Well, bread is one of the great foods of mankind. It's a real invention in the sense that it's nothing like grain. It's a human product where people cleverly learned how to take grain, which is a nice raw material, and turn it into something delicious. And think of it this way. If you were in one of the early agricultural societies that lived primarily on grain, what would you rather have every day, bread or porridge?
it's a bit more appetizing most of the time than gruel. I don't want to backhand porridge because...
Gruel has its place.
Yeah, but... it has its place. So you created an insane data set to work from, 4,300 recipes, almost 6.8 million data points, like hydration, time, heat. So did that yield clusters of proportions that worked? Like, did you find precision after all that?
So I totally thought that we would find precision. Because, first of all, there's just a general thing in cooking that pastry and baking is precise. And partially that's because you can't add the things by taste. You know, it's one thing to say salt to taste or season to taste. You never say add yeast to taste because, A, it doesn't taste that good, and that's not really the metric you're going for. So I thought we would see very clear clusters where a single bread like a brioche or a baguette or some other type of bread would have lots of recipes all clustered together. And it turned out that wasn't true at all.
So does that mean that bread is a much more forgiving, elastic medium for the maker than we imagine it to be?
It totally is. Bread is very forgiving. And I think it's important for people to know that because home bread makers get anxious about it and they think it's very complicated and they think that it's something that just isn't something they ought to be able to do when really it's very forgiving. It's easy and the result's great.
I'm curious, what do you think your grandfather Adolf would have thought of this investigation?
Well, he was a wheat farmer in southern Minnesota. And I think of all the things that I have done in my life, I think this would be the most understandable thing from his perspective. Being a theoretical physicist or chief technology officer at Microsoft, as I have been in the past, is probably a little harder to explain to Grandpa.
Okay, so I kind of just want to pepper you with a bunch of questions.
By all means.
Black ovens, why are they better? I have to tell you that I have a tiny, tiny black oven, and it's better than any big oven I've ever used.
When you bake bread, you're baking at relatively high temperature. So a typical temperature for baking bread would be 450 degrees. The higher the temperature that goes, the more radiative heating is important. Radiative heating means heat from infrared light that goes off of a hot surface. Now, we're all familiar that if you wear a black t-shirt on a sunny day, it's going to get hot, hotter than a white t-shirt would. Black absorbs heat. We all know that. Well, it turns out black also emits heat better than white. So a black inside of an oven or a black cast iron pot is going to be a much better radiator of infrared radiation, which is part of how you're baking your bread. So you really want that.
Well, I wonder if this finding is going to lead to a rethinking of all ovens on the part of the manufacturers.
Ovens are made with lots of compromises in mind. A black surface hides the dirt, which you might say that's a good thing, but in the restaurant world, they kind of like to see it. And ease of cleaning, ease of manufacturing, cheapness. There's all kinds of things that factor into making an oven. So I'm not sure it's going to change at all, but one of our best findings, I think, is if you want to make a crusty bread at home, a crusty French bread or other sorts of bread that has a very crispy crust, you're best off baking it in cheap black cast iron. The fancy cast iron that's all enameled does not work anywhere near as well.
So talking about crust, what's the relationship between steam and crust?
In the 1840s to 1850s, people, probably in Vienna, discovered that if you inject steam into the oven at the beginning of the baking process, you'll get a thin, crisp crust. That's what makes a baguette, for example, very crispy. I first learned this when I read Julia Child's Mastering the Art of French Cooking, and there was a very elaborate recipe in there for baguettes that I tried. I do a much better job now, by the way, because I was like, I don't know, 10, 12 years old at that point. And that recipe had you put on the bottom of your oven a big pan that you would spray water onto with a water sprayer. And that was to try to create the steam that would make the baguette crispy. Well, this really hurt my head because steam and water ought to make stuff soggy, right? Not crispy. How on earth did that work? So this is something that has been a mystery of bread for me for, you know, 40-something years. So we set out to find out, and it turns out that no one actually understood exactly why it worked. And most of the theories had really big holes in them.
So to speak.
Well, in fact, I didn't intend to say this but that way, but it turns out bagels are one of the interesting counterexamples, because bagels are either boiled or, these days, much more often steamed. And you wouldn't call a bagel crispy. You'd call a bagel chewy, but not crispy. So clearly, it wasn't just as simple as steaming. There was some more subtlety to it than that. And we eventually did figure it out. And the full explanation is a little complicated, but basically it has to do with steaming right at the beginning of baking, but only for a short period of time. If you steam for a long time, that makes a thick skin on the outside, and that thick skin acts to us like it's chewy. A thin skin from a very brief steaming actually makes it crispy. And we tested this by taking bagel dough and baking it like a baguette, and baguette dough and baking it like a bagel. And sure enough, the baking process dictated the crispiness or chewiness, not the dough.
So interesting. Your last big project, Modernist Cuisine, the Art and Science of Cooking, was as groundbreaking for the photographs as the information. Can you talk about the role of photography in this book, Modernist Bread?
First of all, thank you for your kind words about our photography. When it came to do a book on bread, we had a little bit of a dilemma on the photographic side because bread is all brown and white. The dough is white to various shades of brown, and when you put it in the oven, it gets browner, but that's about it. So how do you make that interesting? And it turns out that we tried a whole bunch of ways, and a lot of it did involve creating new kinds of equipment. Here's one example. Many people are familiar with a cornstarch gel. You'll see that in certain desserts and so forth, where you can make a clear gel coating. For example, for a fruit pie, we'll often have that. It turns out that there's a clear gel in bread. The crumb of bread, and of course, when a baker says the crumb, they mean the entire center part. The crumb is effectively a clear gel.
What does that mean?
Well, when you look at it with the right kind of microscope, and I had to build a special kind of microscope to do this, it turns out that it looks like shower glass. So most people in their shower have glass that is clear, so it lets light through, but the glass is wavy or distorted, so you get some privacy when you're in there. That's what the bread looks like. Now, it looks white to us or opaque to us for the same reason that fog and clouds look opaque. If you've driven through fog, you know it can be very hard to see, but then if you look on your windshield, what you'll see is tiny little droplets of clear water. So a scientist would say that's due to the scattering of light. Any individual droplet in the cloud is clear, but if you put millions of those droplets together, what you wind up with is something that looks quite white. It scatters light in all directions, and that scattering gives the appearance of being white. Well, that's what the crumb of bread is.
Really, they're really beautiful.
Well, thank you.
I was scrolling through one of the volumes, and I came upon a title of a recipe, a sablé brioche.
Yes.
What in the heck is that? When a baker hears the word sablé, it sort of indicates that it's going to be something with a sandy texture. And then you think about a brioche, which seems to be the opposite of that.
Okay, well, here's the story. So brioche is one of the great breads of the world, and brioche has a lot of butter in it. A typical recipe for brioche is what we'd call a 50% brioche. That means there's half as much butter as there is flour by weight. And sometimes we make even up to a 100% brioche. That's equal weight flour and butter. Mixing all of that butter in and having a nice cohesive dough is not easy. It's actually kind of hard, and it makes most people think of a brioche as an advanced bread. Well, I was trying to think of a way to make brioche simple. And I remembered a classic French pastry dough called pâté sablé, which means a sandy dough, basically. And to make that dough, you add your dry ingredients, sugar and flour, to butter. And then you, at least these days, the way you make it is you blitz it like crazy in a food processor or in a mixer on high. And when you blitz it together, it makes first big clumps, and then it goes down into tiny little sandy nodules. Then you add just a tiny bit of water, and you've got your pie crust, for example. You can also make cookies that way. Well, I thought, well, since beginners have a hard time mixing the butter in. Why don't we do that? Let's take the butter and the flour, blitz it into this sablé, and then let's add our yeast and water to that. And it works great.
I can't wait to get my hands on the actual book. Thank you so much, Nathan.
Oh, my pleasure. It's, well, once you've been as far down the rabbit hole, you're happy to talk about it.
You can find Modernist Bread, The Art and Science by Nathan Myhrvold and Francisco Migoya in bookstores next month. Get a recipe for challah from the book on our blog. Go to blogs.kcrw.com/goodfood. Now let's head to the farmer's market to find out about a cookbook that celebrates a special anniversary this year. Here's Laura Avery with the market report.
2017 marks a 10-year milestone of the Santa Monica Farmer's Market cookbook. Can't believe it. Amelia Salzman, the author, is here. 2007, Amelia, you wrote your love poem to the Santa Monica Farmer's Market, and it's been 10 years. What's new and what's old?
Well, I cannot believe it. And if you would have told me 12 years ago, when I finally settled down to write the book, that it would still be growing strong and helping so many new shoppers come into the market and know what to do, learn what to do, that it should become, what did you call it, the go-to reference, is just, I never would have believed it. It was beyond my wildest dreams. I'm thrilled. Just thrilled to keep telling the stories of our farmers.
And when you wrote the book, you have so many beautiful photographs of the farmers, and then every recipe talks about the farm that the produce came from. You have your chef's tips. It really is a way to just pick up and read about the farmer's market. And then if you come home and you've got a piece of kohlrabi you don't know what to do with, you pick up this book and sure enough, there's a recipe.
Yes, thank you. That is exactly what I set out to do because I knew that I was unfamiliar with certain things. And then as I was doing cooking demos here at the market to help promote some of these ingredients for the farmers, I saw that people really weren't sure. So that there is really something we need to talk about. And I'm excited that it had such far-reaching effect. Mm-hmm. You know, it's been, people use it wherever they live.
Amelia, you're a chef for all seasons. Tell us what you're shopping now as we head into November.
Well, I'm finding gorgeous pineapple quince at Terry Ranch. And I think most people don't know what to do with quince. It looks like a furry, knobbly apple, rock hard, which it is. But it's an ancient sort of storage crop. Some people think it is the apple in the Garden of Eden. And it is related to an apple. It is a pome fruit. When you cut into it, you do find that typical seed cavity with the five little seeds. Now, my secret for coring the quince, so you think about how you would work with an apple, only much harder. Cut it in half or quarters, and then use an oyster knife to dig out the core, and it'll protect your hand. That's what an oyster knife has, is that sort of scabbard, like a sword, but short and stubby, and it'll just come out pretty quickly.
And you're holding one now, and it is pretty much rock hard, so tell us how you prepare it.
What I like to do is make a kind of almost a stew, a savory braise, if you will, of sweet, sour quince, which is what their profile is, their flavor is, with sweet potatoes or carrots or butternut squash, chunks of that. So you right away, you can see we've got this autumnal orange. We've got this lovely sort of rosy pink flesh of the quince. When they cook, they turn a nice pink color. And then I like to serve that as either a side dish, which is great for Thanksgiving, by the way, or you could add meat to it and make it a real stew. So you've got this sweet and savory beef or pork stew. Or just as a vegetarian main dish, over a coat of brown rice would be wonderful, and then seasoned and made more colorful with pomegranate arils. So you've got color, you've got contrast, a lot of things happening just from what we've got on offer here at the market.
Beautiful. What a gorgeous fall dish. And thank you for reintroducing us to the quince. It is a beautiful thing. I do believe that those are the subject of a lot of medieval paintings. They might have appeared on those tapestries. And I think there's a couple of quince trees in the cloisters in New York City.
I would agree with that. I think I've heard tell that Christopher Columbus brought quince with him to the New World because he knew it would keep in the hold.
Right. Okay, well, good. Quince lore and then a quince recipe and all good things in the fall. And thank you, as always, for inspiring us to have fresh eyes and taste buds here at the market.
My pleasure, and thank you.
That was Amelia Salzman. She is the author of the Santa Monica Farmers Market Cookbook, and she's delighting us with fall flavors and getting us just racing out to find some quince. We're talking now with Becky Terry, who's the farmer who grows quince. Her farm is located in Dinuba, which is the heart of the San Joaquin Valley. Becky, you come in this time of year, you got your quince. Tell us the variety you grow, why you grow it, and what does a quince taste like?
Well, you know what? We did a lot of research before we decided to grow the variety that we grow. We grow a pineapple quince, which is the largest quince, so that when you're buying that, you get a bigger piece of fruit to work with. And that's really important to the chefs. They don't really want to peel little things that are like quarter size. And you ask me what a quince tastes like, I'm going to give you two answers. It's a cooking fruit first. If you're going to eat it raw, it's very, very chewy because it's got a lot of pectins in it. It almost feels like you're going to break your jaw. But it has that apple taste overlaying, and right now you can actually even taste a little bit of juice in it. Mm-hmm. Once it's cooked, that heat changes that pectin texture. So it's a sweet, succulent apple with vanilla overtones. It's just absolutely awesome. If you're going to poach it, you're going to put it in a pastry. Most of us know it as quince paste that they would get in finer restaurants with their cheese tray.
Like a membrillo, like a quince jelly.
Correct.
And because it has so much pectin, it probably just sets up all by itself.
It does. It's about a 6 to 7 hour process to make membrillo or quince paste. And it's basically you're reducing that fruit down in its purest form with a small amount of sugar, cane mm-hmm. sugar, obviously. And sometimes they will put a little bit of lemon zest in there to bring that out.
Okay. Now, when you've got that quince on your table, people walk up. It looks like a dirty apple that's got fuzz all over it. What do you tell people? How do you get them to focus on the quince?
Well, I actually tell them my easy and quick way of processing it and how I use it in my own house. I actually take the quince. Obviously, you're going to wash it because it has fuzz like a peach, skin like an apple, and it has a core inside like a pear. So you take that and you cut it in quarters using your big muscles because it's got lots of pectin in it. Put it in a saute pan with butter, crisp the edges, turn the heat down, put your lid on it and let it weep. It'll change from a white texture to a pink clear in about 35 to 40 minutes. Bring your temperature back up. You're going to add cinnamon and sugar and caramelize that sugar. I say that you can use that as a topping for ice cream, which is always lots of fun. Put it on Greek yogurt or oatmeal. I actually take a pork loin and slice it lengthways, put a couple spoonfuls in the middle and skewer it back together and bake it, and it's to die for.
That's wonderful. And so how many trees do you have right now?
Of the 178 acres in California, and we're the largest quince growing state in the lower 48, we have 11.
There are only 170 acres total of quince in California?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, okay. Not a real popular fruit then.
I'll say they're a pain to grow.
Okay. So 11 acres, is that might be one of the bigger orchards?
Oh, I'd hate to think that we're a large grower.
Okay, with 11 acres. Yeah.
Yes.
But 170 acres statewide.
Yeah.
So the quince season is late fall all the way through. Are we going to have this all the way till Christmas, into New Year?
We should have them all the way through Thanksgiving. If you want to purchase that last week or two, take them to your home, put them in your refrigerator, put them on your counter. That's one way that you can self-store them for the Christmas holiday.
Thank you, Becky.
Oh, thank you very much for the time this morning.
And Becky's also at our Santa Monica Wednesday, Saturday downtown, and Sunday markets, as long as she's got quince. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
We close out the show on the savory side. That's after this short break. Stay with us. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman.
Probably 90% of the time in this country when you're eating smoked fish, whether it's from the deli or from Costco or any other number of supermarkets, it's coming from Acme. I mean, they're kind of the biggest out there, and they've been doing it a long time, and they do it to a really high level. They have a great product.
Michael Wexler is one of the owners of Wexler's Deli in L.A. He doesn't buy smoked fish from Acme, that big company he was just talking about. Instead, Wexler's smokes all their fish in-house.
The ingredient that we start with is of the utmost importance to us, and I think it's the thing that sets us apart in the deli world, in the smoked fish world, which is, I want to know what this fish is eating, I want to know where it's raised, I want to know what it's swimming in and who's touching it and everything that's going on. And so we looked at a number of different fish to be able to do that with our salmon, and we settled on a farm by the name of Backafrost, which is in the Faroe Islands, and it is really the benchmark fish for salmon aquaculture. It's non-GMO feed, it doesn't get antibiotics, it doesn't get hormones, it's raised in open ocean pens that have clean water going through it, and it's a really, really high quality product. And I think there's, you know, a lot of reading out there these days on where does your salmon come from and what goes into it and whatever, and it's like anything else. I mean, not all of these farms are created equal. Certain farms, just like a chicken farm, there's good ones and there's bad ones, and they have different practices.
Acme's buying all their fishes farmed.
Yeah. I mean, we like farmed salmon better for lox, which is what we make, because of the fact that it has a really nice, even fat distribution. It has a high fat content. So we get a really nice, silky, smooth slice out of it, and it's very consistent. So I actually prefer the taste and texture and the mouthfeel of it over the wild salmon. So it's a conscious decision, and then to make that decision to say, okay, well, let's get the best one, the most sustainable, the most healthily, environmentally raised salmon. From there, we cure it in a mix of salt, sugar, some herbs, and citrus, and some spices. And it sits on cure, you know, depending on the fish, for usually about 40, 48 hours. We wash it off the cure. We go through a drying process that pulls additional moisture out of the fish and tightens up the flesh, but also intensifies the flavors. And then we smoke it very quickly, actually, for it's cold smoke for about an hour to an hour and a half. Gets a little bit of additional drying time. And then we slice it and goes on the best bagel, cream cheese, capers, and onions.
Are you concentrating right now on salmon and on this cold smoke product? Do you make lox, which is a completely different kettle of fish, I would say?
It is. Lox is one of those things that there's so much confusion about, right? What is lox? What is smoked salmon? It's actually very simple. I mean, lox is just a cured piece of salmon. It doesn't actually get any smoke on it. However, we decided when we opened up that, you know, when you go to the Jewish deli, you ask for a bagel and lox. You don't ask for a bagel and smoked salmon because it's kind of bougie and just, you know, lox is what we grew up with, right? We did feel also that people identify a little bit of that smoked flavor with lox in general. So even though technically speaking, lox is not smoked, most people think of lox as being smoked. So we wanted to have this sort of back note of smoke on our lox. So we do call it lox. We refer to it as lox.
It's our Nova, style. It's really.
Yeah. It's
Nova.
If you were to really pen it down, it's Scottish style smoked salmon. So Nova is the salmon goes into a brine, which means that it's curing in a wet solution. And with Scottish style, it's cured. So it's packed in the salt and sugar as opposed to going into that brine.
Are you going to expand to, like, whitefish and kippered salmon?
Yeah, I mean, we do that stuff in the store now. I mean, one of the things that's been nice about our Santa Monica location, because we have this bigger kitchen there that's a lot more well-equipped than our original space in Grand Central, is we've really been able to offer a wider breadth of all of the classic appetizing Jewish deli fish offerings. So we have pastrami lox now. We have kippered salmon. We have whitefish salad, kippered salmon salad, barbecue cod. You know, that really brings back the childhood memories, that fish. And it's actually something
orange.
It's funny. We've been working on it, I would say, for about close to 2 years now. It's a really, really difficult fish to get down. There's no real knowledge base on it to go back to old recipes or old techniques and say, oh, this is the way in which you do this. So we really had a lot of trial and error. And that orange look comes from red number four and all that other kind of fake stuff that goes in there. We obviously didn't want to put those things into it because we have a natural approach to everything we do. So the very first step was figuring out how are we going to give it that color, because it's got to have that color. There's something about it.
And natto seed?
Yeah. Okay. So I have this stuff that I developed called Sable Magic. And it basically started off with everything orange food pigment that I could think of. So yeah, it's got natto seed, it's got achiote, and a couple of other things. So that was the first thing to perfect. And then what we really struggled with, because black cod, you know, sometimes it's called butterfish, has such a buttery, flaky texture, was essentially, how do you dry it right and how do you cook it right so that you can get a slice out of it and it doesn't just fall apart or it's not mushy. And that was very frustrating.
It's just that beautiful flake that you just pull off the bone with your fork.
That was frustrating to figure out, but we finally got it.
Do you expect the interest in smoked fish to grow?
I do. A lot of times there's this sort of negative outlook on some of this stuff of what it is, because the truth of the matter is, I mean, a lot of the smoked fish packages that you'll open up that you buy from the supermarket or you get at the deli, they're not that good. And they're usually cut very thick, which means it's going to be, you know, have this sort of chew to it or be mealy or be stringy. And there's nothing worse than that. I mean, so much of what makes our fish so great is the way that we hand slice it and get those really thin, silky slices that just sort of fall apart when you bite into them. And so I think that we have turned a lot of people onto smoked fish who maybe weren't into it or only kind of into it before. And we're really trying to grow that market more and more. I mean, I think of it just as much as charcuterie or salumi making. It's really very similar to that. And look where that's come in 10 years. You know, 10 years ago, were people seeing head cheese on a menu? No chance. Now they're at Bestia eating a ton of it.
That's Michael Wexler, co-owner of Wexler's Deli, giving us the lowdown on how they select, cure, and smoke their fish. Sample the wares at their locations in Grand Central Market, Santa Monica, and Century City. That's it for this week's show. If you missed any part of it, you can listen to the show on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. You can also download our show wherever you get your podcasts. As always, so many thanks to the Good Food team. Welcome to Nick Liao, the new managing producer of KCRW's Good Food, Laurel Garcia, Rosalie Atkinson, Joseph Stone, Joel Stein, and Ronnie Mickelson. Of course, you know who I am. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.